Howdy folks, welcome to Newsprint Commando Pacific Comics Tuesday. Today I'm looking at the books that Pacific put out in November of 1982. Two books. Silver Star number one is first up. This is a Jack Kirby creation, scripted and penciled by Mr. Kirby, inked by Mike Royer, colored by Janice Cohen, and lettered by Mike Royer. Now, the cover that we have here is brought to us by Mr. Kirby, Mike Thibodeau, and Alfredo Alcala. The book itself can be found reprinted in a couple places. One is the Silver Star Graphic Edition put out by Tomorrow's Publishing in 2006. And the other is a collected edition, Jack Kirby's Silver Star, put out by Image in 2007. Now, the interesting thing about the graphite edition from Tomorrow's Publishing is that it has all six issues of just Jack Kirby's pencils and actually maybe some inked pages if they weren't able to find just the penciled pages from Kirby. No colors, no letters either, I believe. Let me check on that real quick here. No, I was wrong. That is lettered. It's just not colored, and for a large portion, it's not inked, although there are some inked pages because those were the only pages they were able to find of those particular issues, particular stories. There's also a second five-page story entitled Last of the Viking Heroes, and this comes to us from Mike Thibodeau, created, written, and drawn, inked by Alfredo Alcala, lettered by Kerry McCarthy, and colored by Shelley Lefferman. But first up, we have Morgan Miller's story here in Silver Star. Front cover, we have Silver Star kind of in an action pose. Behind him, though, we have an image of another individual that is energized from inside, kind of as a shadow. We're told that this is a visual novel, so I guess all six episodes put together, six issues put together, would be a visual novel. Then we have an indication plus Viking Last of the Heroes here. Inside front cover, an advert for Star Slayer Log of the Jolly Roger issue number 5 that is on sale now. We've already talked about issue number 5. Narrator tells us on the first story page, happiness and Holocaust forever surprise us. They generate and grow and prepare to penetrate our lives from the very spot we never watch. The baseball fan calls it left field, but in this case, let's call him Silver Star, Homo geneticus. The issue starts with a young lady. Her name is Tracy, and come to find out she's actually patterned after Jack Kirby's granddaughter at the time. This came out in 1983, but it's my understanding that this was something that Jack had in his drawer in 75, 77, something like that. So he'd worked on this, and then nobody was able to buy it. He intended it for a screenplay. Nobody was able to buy it or wanted to buy it, and he put it back. And then in 1981, after having been out of the industry for a couple years, Pacific Comics had approached him, and they'd already been doing the Galactic Rangers book, Captain Victory. And they went back into the well and asked Jack if he had anything else, and he pulled this out of the drawers. So Tracy is singing to us, and those song lyrics come courtesy of Susan Kirby. And it's just a song. I don't know how to describe it, really. It's going on. The second page of the story is Tracy playing a guitar, singing the song. Various, instead of panels of her, they're just images of her as if she is walking or wandering down a path singing. Then we cut to a scene of Vietnam where a group of soldiers are being attacked by a tank. And after a particularly vicious sortie, one of the men has some kind of reaction that is triggered biochemically in his body. And he loses himself in having to do something to save himself and his men. So he throws his rifle down and walks up and grabs the tank and hefts it and then starts throwing it around until finally he throws it away from he and his men. Next page, more images of Tracy singing the song. Then we get to the meat of the story here. Morgan Miller is our protagonist. He's going to be Silver Star. But we're also introduced to Walter Hammer, who is a doctor in charge of looking after him. Seems that after his exertion and everything, he just collapsed. He went comatose. So Dr. Hammer has been taking care of him. We're also introduced to Floyd Custer, who's a gentleman from somewhere. He's a suit, okay? He's wanting to know and assess the abilities of this Morgan Miller to do again under controlled conditions what he has already done and hopefully continue to do it rather than falling into a coma as he has here. So Walter and Floyd are discussing things in the medical facility where Morgan is outside. They go back in and we see that now Morgan is being put into a silver shielded suit that covers his entire body except for his face. It leaves his face exposed. And we see also more evidence that Morgan is just in a coma. He's non-responsive, unresponsive, whatever, whichever word you want. Then we go elsewhere, because that's where Morgan Miller is. And elsewhere, he meets Tracy. And he's having a grand old time with Tracy, taking her around and showing her different things in this oddly imaginative universe that they're a part of. But she's afraid. She's seeing and being exposed to a lot of things that is a little girl, a young child, I don't know, probably mid to late single digit ages is what she appears to me to be. She's not as excited as Morgan is to just flit around and travel around and see things and then zoom around over here and see things and fly through the stars and the universe and whatever else is going on here, which is what Morgan is doing. We're also introduced to an individual that here in a bit we will find out is named Darius Drumm, D-R-U-M-M, two M's, Darius Drumm. He is also in this make-believe world, and he is spying on Morgan in particular. So we cut back to the real world where Walter and Floyd are continuing to have their conversation. We see a almost like an x-ray image of Morgan at this point, and he is filled with like stars and energy pockets that are bursting and things like that. Almost like you would look up into the night sky and if you magnified it to where all those little teeny dots were bigger and you only saw like, you know, four or five of the dots at this distance. That's kind of what the inside of Morgan's body looks like. So as they're moving Morgan to a, they've completely surrounded him in this silver suit and they're moving him to a place so that they have their OR and their research facility not taken up by this comatose person. He starts to grow and he is on two gurneys being hefted along by five full-grown men, but he's continuing to grow because in the other world, our narrator tells us that poor Homo geneticus, his journey will be no less painful than ours, for he too has a brother named Cain, the one who wants to be king of the hill. Now, this Cain is referring to Darius Drumm. After this issue itself, I don't know if Cain truly is the biological brother or why brother. Maybe it's brother in situation is the reference. But Darius has caused a mechanical creature of large size to attack Morgan Miller in this other world. And to combat that, Miller has grown to the same size as the robot. And we find Darius saying, well, that's interesting. I never expected you to do that. But good on you, kid, because you're going to have to beat this dude. And that makes the most sense is to grow to equal proportions to beat him. And then after Silver Star beats him, he realizes that Darius is here. And Darius and he go back and forth a little bit. Darius calling him Bumpkin and Hayseed and these other weird words. And then he disappears. And when Darius Drumm disappears in the real world, Morgan Miller wakes up. And for the first time, he's able to converse with these doctors and other soldiers For the first time since he had this transformation out on the battlefield. No real indication in story time how long that's been, but it's been several days, it seems. We also have some head narration here from Mr. Floyd Custer, and we find out that he's a little bit more into things for his own good and for the people he represents than for Morgan Miller's own good. And the foremost among the others, dangerous and deadly Darius Drum. A lot of alliteration there. The narrator tells us to finalize the story. Good action pieces, good color, good Kirby art. Fortunately, the dialogue is a little bit better than what I was lamenting in, what was it, issue 8 of the Galactic Rangers. Kirby's doing quite a bit better there. We're going to find out as this series goes along and as the Captain Victory goes along in time, in real time, Jack Kirby gets sick. And so his creative juices and his ability to create start to falter a little bit. It'll become more apparent in his drawings over the next next year-ish or so, maybe a little longer, year and a half, that it takes to finish up this series and get through what he does for the Galactic Rangers. And actually, by that time, a year and a half or so, Pacific Comics will be coming to an end and packing up shop. So kind of fortuitous that it coincides. This will turn out to be, I believe, if we check into it, the last really Kirby creation that we see. Now, he might take on some other people's properties and mess with them a little bit here over the next 6-8 years, I believe. Let's see, 94, I think, is when he died. Yeah, so we'll have to keep an eye on that, particularly when it comes to the art, because Heckfire, at this point, Jack Kirby's artwork is far and away what he's known for. His creativity overall, but his artwork. Next page is an advert for Wild Animals, full page, which actually we'll get to here in a little bit. Coming in 1983, Michael Moorcock's Elric of Melniboné, thank you, Stephen, an all-new adaptation by Roy Thomas, P. Craig Russell, Michael Gilbert, a Starreach production. So Starreach sets it up, and then it is published, apparently, through Pacific Comics. Last of the Viking Heroes, I gave you the creatives, but in case you missed it, Michael Thibodeau, creator, writer, and artist. Inked by Alfredo Alcala. Lettered by Kerry McCarthy. Colored by Shelley Lefferman. The Vikings ruled the land and sea for over 2 centuries. Their reign faded in the latter part of the 10th century, not at the hand of foe or plague, merely that they had become civilized themselves. These Vikings of the 11th century, though most are not the barbaric warriors of yesteryear, still count among them a handful who possess the inner strength to be last of the Viking heroes. We have 4 individuals here, one of which is holding a young lad. The demon has struck again, the adult holding the young boy says. Another family victimized, Commander Ekthro, his wife and son, brutally murdered. Maid Adrian has been abducted. If we find this demon, we will find Commander Ethro's daughter. So we have 4 individuals here, John, Tomgar, Eric, and dude, unfortunately, whose name I do not seem to have written down, so I'm not sure. But they are the last of the Viking heroes. Oh, sorry about that, I am an error. The 4th individual is just their prince who is giving them their mission. So we have Tom, who looks like a wizard with the big pointy cap on his head. Tomgar, who looks very much like a Native American or what they're trying to pass off as Native American. And then Eric, who probably looks the most Viking-like. He's got a helmet with big feathery wings on either side, much like Thor of Marvel Comics. So our 3 heroes set off, and they stop on the way to wherever they're going to find this demon. And they speak to a wizard who gives them a magic gem. At some point, they are attacked in the journey afterwards. They're attacked by a demon. Tomgar, being the saving grace, he manages to eviscerate the demon. Or so they thought, but no. The demon is not hurt much by the sword that Tomgar uses. So John gathers this gem that the wizard gave them and holds it out to the demon, thinking that the poetic words of wisdom, I guess you would say, that the wizard uttered would come true in this particular usage. And they're kind of, you know, like you'll see in prose and whatnot, the instructions or the outcome of using the magical device will usually be some sort of flowery language or prose that you then have to figure out, kind of like a riddle. Well, John errs in trying to determine this riddle because he holds the gem out, believing that it will do something to the demon. And unfortunately, no, the demon just gives him the major backhand from hell here and throws him several feet. Tomgar once again attacks him with sword and attempts to eviscerate him, but he pokes him through two or three times, and ultimately the demon runs away. He's not killed. So John, Tomgar, and Eric now are gathered and they're catching their breath. They mount their horses and continue on their journey, and a little while later they find a young lady just laying in a field. It's the missing maid Adrian. She's breathing. The demon must have left her for dead. Yeah, I'm suspicious reading this. So she wakes up, and it is Eric that is holding her when she wakes up, and he's there and starts taking care of her. He then goes to Eric's horse and gets the magic gem that the wizard gave them and gives it to her. And they see that the gem, bright and glowy and bubbly and radiant and everything, or actually we see it, and Eric sees it as it happens too. But over time, the gem dims and dims and dims until it is not lustry, shiny at all. Eric notices this and snatches the gem off of her. And after leaving her person for a little while, it brightens up and starts to glow again. And that's when Eric realizes that the key to the riddle is the gem being a reflection of the individual holding it rather than the gem actually having a power to do something. So because it got all dark and what have you as it was around the neck of the woman, they now know that the woman is the true demon, and so they attack it and kill it. And in several panels here is they're bemoaning how they were taken by this tricky demon and all. It changes from the face of the woman to the face of the demon, which is the same demon that they had attacked a little bit earlier on. Leaving the woman, the three mount up and ride off. Thus ends the first saga, but by no means the last in the lives of the last of the Viking heroes, were told us by the narrator. Inside Backcover has comic subscriptions make great gifts, and we're told about Captain Victory, Silver Star, Gru the Wanderer, Elric of Melniboné, Twisted Tales, and Alien Worlds. I've talked about Captain Victory, Silver Star, Gru, and Twisted Tales. Elric and Alien Worlds coming up shortly. Back cover, full color. Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers advert. This is advertising issue number 9, which is the next one coming up. It'll be on sale in December, which is next month. So we may well, in our next Pacific Tuesday, be talking about the next Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers. I am not sure. Let me consult my handy-dandy listy here. Alien Worlds, Captain Victory 9, and Gru number 2. So there we go. So Alien Worlds number 1, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers number 9, and Gru number 2 are what's next for our next Pacific Comics Tuesday. But wait, that's not all for this episode, kids. We have Wild Animals issue number 1, Anthropomorphic Antics of Funny Fauna, we're told. Now, I attempted this several times over the past couple days, but I have not been able to read this book. Funny Animal comics are not my bag. I can't hang with them, but I'll do my best to describe this book to you anyways. It is full color, and there are 10 different stories in here of varying lengths. So plenty of funny animal comics for you if you like. And it is 36 pages only. So it's a standard Pacific Comics anyways size, but Lots of different things. Front cover, wild animals, full color. All of the different main characters from the book are here. We see copyright by Scott Shaw on the cover. Yuall Gibbon is a major character. He's got a little inset down here in the lower left hand, featuring the return of, we're told. And the main character here is walking down a street in a suit, carrying a suitcase. Looks like he's been to Sioux City, Duckburg, and Zanytown, because those are stickers on his traveling briefcase here. But he's a cross of, I don't know, six different animals here, it looks like, eight. A giraffe, a beaver, a duck with some kind of claws on its feet. What would that be? Would that be a one of the marsupials? A platypus, maybe, has claws like that. Elephant trunk, tusks, horns. Yeah, just a group of animals. Then the inside front cover, wild animals, we're told. And we have a black and white sketch of this major individual that we see on the cover walking down the street. And the walking down the street, the cover itself, it looks to be, I don't know that this is what they did per se, but it almost looks like it's one of those styles where drawings are laid over a photograph, the photograph being actual buildings and street that the characters are on, and then the different main characters of the stories are overlaid on top of that. I believe that's the kind of the technique that it looks like they employed here for this. So we open up and we have the very first story being the longest. It's a 12-pager involving this Yuall Gibbon. That's Y-O-U-A-L-L Gibbon. Probably a play on Yule Gibbons. Gibbons, I believe, is his last name. What is he? Actor and host. But this is a baboon with curly white hair. And we're told that this story, as it starts here, is a continuation of a story that was in Quack issue number 3. Now, Quack is a Star Reach production book. Issue number 3 came out in 77. So that would be 5 years ago. So the fact that Scott Shaw had this story in his head for 5 years and had not found a place to produce it, kind of interesting to me. I'd like to ask Scott about that. I checked to see if this character was in Quack 3. I didn't follow up to see if Scott Shaw had anything in 4 or 5. I believe that this story started in one of the earlier, if not the two earlier issues of Quack. The entire volume only went like, I think, 5 issues, maybe 6 from Star Reach. So, as is my wont, that is the end of really the research I did to the character. Again, funny animals are just not my gag, but lots of small panels for the story, Scott Shaw seems very much more a cartoonist, I think, is what people would classify him in the ranks of art, the type of art here. This definitely looks like a story that I would have seen in any number of the anthropomorphic books that were coming out in the late 70s, early 80s. Albedo, the books from Thoughts and Images, early books from Fantagraphics that were not pornographic, although Fantagraphics did have pornographic anthropomorphic books as well. Other books that used funny animals to relay adult topics and sexual situations, I guess, I don't know, that kind of, no pun intended, softened the blow, if you will, I guess, using animals. I don't know, but they did it a lot there in the early days. This story, after 12 pages, comes to an end. We have the end here. So Scott Shaw held on to this story for 5 years just to finish it in 12 pages. Again, kind of interesting that it didn't show up anywhere else. It's entitled The Land That Time Forgot. As I said, Yuall Gibbon is the main character. Scripted, penciled, and inked by Scott Shaw with an assist from Joshua Quagmire on the inks, Gordon Kent in the colors, and Scott finishing up with the letters. Next story is a 3-pager, The No Luck Duck. And this involves Clark the Collector, who is a duck dressed in a, Kind of like a hobo, looks like, in a suit here. So he's seen better days. I've seen better days. Yeah, like that. George Erling, scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered with colors by Gordon Kent. I'm sorry about the breaking into spontaneous song there. I don't know what hit me. Three pages. One of the pages is four covers of pretend books. Animal Heap Comics, Barnyard Bog, Dumpy Ducks, Space Ace, and Smooch Comics. So, not sure what the story is there. This artwork is a little bit sketchier than what Scott Shaw was on the Ewall Gibbons story. Next up, we have Orange Sauce, starring Bronte. That's a four-pager, scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered by Larry Gonick, with colors by Gordon Kent. Again, I didn't necessarily read it. The star is Bronte. He is a Brontosaurus, so it's in a medieval world with anthropomorphic dinosaurs. Right before that, we have a full-page ad for Coming Soon, Sergio Aragonés, Gru the Wanderer. Subscribe today, but we know it has already come and gone. They dropped the first issue that I spoke about last Pacific Tuesday. I believe it was last. Anyways, in one of the previous Pacific Tuesdays. And as I looked at our list earlier, next Pacific Tuesday has the next Gru issue even. So hold on, guys. There is more Gru a-coming. Next page is an advert for a Tim Conrad four-plate portfolio. Pacific Comics started getting into portfolios. I guess they were easy to produce, and they had a lot of return on investment. There's one that piqued my interest that I actually looked up to see how much it costs nowadays from Wendy and Richard Peeney from ElfQuest. They did a portfolio here with Pacific. Next page, on sale now in Pacific Comics number one, The Rocketeer. This is from Pacific Presents, a three-issue miniseries. Sold only through direct sales outlets. There are no subscriptions to this title. Aha, so you have to go to a comic store at this time to get Pacific Presents. Next up, we have Toys Will Be Toys, a one-pager starring Harry Canary. This is scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered by Jim Engel. Colored by Gordon Kent. Next page is a Silver Star advert. Just got done talking about the first issue of it. Oh, and a Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers advert. So this is a Jack Kirby advert for us here for Pacific Comics. You can get a subscription to either of those or a free fantasy catalog here by checking and sending this off. Doesn't tell us how much the catalog is, so I guess it's free, it says. Okay, so six issues of Silver Star or Captain Victory are only $5.50, so that's less than a buck an issue, which it says on the covers that they're a buck each, so you get a break if you subscribe. Next up, we have Citizens Band Radio, starring Bungalow Bill, a one-pager, scripted, penciled, inked, and colored by Jim Engel again, or lettered. Scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered by Jim Engel, colored by Gordon Kent. Next up is A Short Story. That's the title of it. And this is by Sergio Aragonés. Scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered with colors by Gordon Kent. And this appears to involve a group of gorillas. Giant gorillas, like kaiju size. And here we go. Here is the next page is an advert for that aforementioned ElfQuest portfolio. This says ElfQuest 3 portfolio. So I guess they produced 1 and 2 somewhere else. Shanes and Shanes are the producer for this. That is a more high-end kind of production name that Pacific Comics used for higher end products, Shanes and Shanes. They were actually a known commodity in the direct market at the time. And they had already always been part of Pacific, but they had produced high end product through that name. So here is an advert for that. It is $12 for 12 color plates. 9 1/4 by 12 1/4. So those are pretty big plates at just a buck a piece of Wendy, actually, her husband's not mentioned. So I guess it's just Wendy Pini's art. I guess she did everything. Cool beans. Next up is The Rabbit Marauder, starring Bungalow Bill, a one-pager. Scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered by Jim Engel again, colored by Gordon Kent. Jim Engel, hopefully he got paid because he did some work in this book. He did a lot of stuff. Next page is Mole in a Hole, W-H-O-L-E, starring Crawford Crowe. It is a two-thirds page strip here. Scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered by Brian Norell. Colors by Gordon Kent. Gordon Kent needs to have made some bank on this book too, because he pretty much, looking through here, colored everything except for the front cover. So they used one colorist for everybody's stuff. Interesting decision, because he kind of had to vary his coloring technique depending on the artwork and the style of the story. So that was a lot of work for him. The bottom third of this final story page is Wild Animal Auditions, and it is scripted, penciled, inked, and lettered by Brian Norell. Not really sure who colored it, but I'll go ahead and throw out there that it was Gordon Kent. He just didn't take credit for it. Don't know. Okay. Next page is a Silver Star full page advert for the visual novel. Look for Jack Kirby's Wildest New Concept. Yeah, we looked and talked. Shambling Your Way This Fall, inside back cover. Twisted Tales, issue number one. I said we had spoken about the first one. I think we did late last year, maybe. And then on the back cover, very interesting back cover. It is a series of panels, one for each, drawing of the presidents of the United States up until that point, starting with Washington and going to Reagan. And each panel is a different animal. This is scripted, penciled, inked, colored, and lettered by Rick Geary, the presidents of the United States. I'm not sure what this was. This is reprinted in At Home with Rick Geary, collected story 77 through 85 that comes out in 1985 from Fantagraphics. So what, 3 years? 3 years from now? Yeah. But, aardvarks and lemurs and rabbits, snakes, dugongs, frogs, roosters. Ronald Reagan is a catfish. And it's mainly just the head of these creatures. Ulysses S. Grant is some kind of bug. Maybe a weevil, maybe a boll weevil. I don't understand the choices. I don't know if it's signifying Andrew Jackson's a grasshopper. If there's something more to it that I'm just not aware of, or I've seen photographs or portraits of most of these presidents, and I don't think they necessarily bear any physical resemblance to these creatures. So that's not why they were chosen. Presidents of the United States, Rick Geary, 1982. Yeah, I'm not sure what the point of that is. It's interesting. It's different. It'd be kind of cool if this was a series of collector cards. I actually could be quickly persuaded to buy those, because that would be pretty cool to have. Buy them then. I wouldn't want to buy them now. I have plenty of cards here in my room. So there we go, guys. Sorry if that wasn't as well done as maybe if my coverage of other books can be described as being well done. Funny animal stories, just they don't work for me. A lot of times I don't get it, so it falls kind of flat. So there we go. Silver Star number one, which will go on 6 issues total. Wild Animals number one, and which this is it for Pacific Comics. So that's all we're going to get of those. The books Pacific put out in November of 1982. Next up, I will be looking at X-Mutants number 2, the next episode of Newsprint Commando. And the next Pacific Tuesday will be, as I said, Alien Worlds number 1, Captain Victory and the Galactic Rangers number 9, and Gru number 2. So hang on and listen for whichever of those, or both if they interest you. Either way, I will talk to you guys in a little bit. Ciao.